Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to Flow Guitar Enthusiasts with Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Great tone. Everyone can tell what it is, but how do you get it? With so many styles of music, with new gear coming out almost daily, what's the secret to great tone? Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, where we talk about tone, what it is, and how to get it. With your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, we will talk to the creators of tone, the manufacturers, and the players as we explore tone and the gear that gets it.
Tonight on the Flow Guitar Enthusiasts, we welcome back Steve Hunter, guitar player for such greats as Lou Reed, Alice Cooper, and Peter Gabriel. Steve has just released a new live album called Tone Poems, and Legends with legends like Tony Levin and others. We will be talking with him about his recording and his scratch guitars and all the gear he used on this record. Flow Guitar Enthusiasts is proudly sponsored by Sweetwater Musical Instruments and Pro Audio at www.sweetwater.com. And now here are your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show tonight. We have a great show for you, and I'm officially titling it not just about tone, but about taste. Scott, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm excited to have another fellow Decatur, Illinois person on the show.
Yes, you're going to be over there soon.
I'm going to go back. It's going to be cold, but that's all right. But, so I'm excited to have Steve back on. So, you know, I mean, I would like to say that he's the second favorite son of Decatur. I mean, me being the first. But, but I think he's probably a little...
He came first, Scott.
A little more awesome than I am.
He came first. So he You're just be. A youngster.
Yeah, I know. I'm not quite as cool.
So what have you been up to?
Yeah, I've been checking out quite a few things. I've been checking out the new Audio-Technica M50X headphones, which are basically a new version of the headphones that we're wearing right now. They're really, really cool. Really digging them.
Are we going to see a demo?
Yes, you will. Well, there's not a whole lot to demo, but a review at least.
Okay.
And then speaking of demos, in the spirit of Steve Hunter, make sure to go to my YouTube channel and check out my demo on the Steve Hunter String Change Buddy that I did.
That's right.
It's a cool little device for all you guys that love to use Bigsby guitars. This is something you can't live without.
Yes, as a owner of several Bigsbys, yes, it is a life-changing thing to use. It saves you a lot of time and a lot of frustration when those things pop out.
Yeah, I mean, I think I should have written the website down, but I believe it's stevehunterstringchangebuddy.com or stringchangebuddy.com. Either way, just Google it and you'll find it.
Yeah.
And it's less than a cup of coffee at Starbucks if you get a grande. So buy it and help the guy out that invented it because it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, and it, not just that, it's a great thing to use. It's a great thing.
But watch my video first.
Yes, and also, too, check out Scott's Bruce Kulick videos on his special BK model guitar. It was it's a very cool video.
Yeah,
it's
a
cool guitar.
Yeah, so you can check out my YouTube channel at Selenium. What have you been up to, Jeff?
Well, I've been busy making phone calls and doing stuff because while Scott is away, the Flow will play. So, anyway, I'm going to give you a kind of little rundown of what's happening. Of course, next week, we have Andrew York coming on formerly from the LA Guitar Quartet, which is going to be really interesting. But I just got confirmations. December 15th, Ron Marino is going to join me back with David Phillip, who's another pedalboard designer. He's done a lot of stuff for Landau, for a bunch of different people, and including Tim Pierce. And Tim Pierce is going to be on in studio. He's a contemporary of Lee Ritenour, Jay Grade, and all these session guys that have done most of the hits during the 70s, 80s, and 90s. So that's really exciting. I'm really looking forward to that. December 22nd, on the 15th, my guest host, you can never be replaced, but the closest I can get, Jim Stubblefield's going to come in from Incendio. He's going to come by. And so he'll be there helping me. And then on the 22nd, Prescott Niles, formerly of The Knack, will be on, and he's also playing now with Missing Persons. He'll be on. My guest host will be J.P. Duran from Incendio. So it's going to be fun. And then you'll be back on the 29th, and that's our punk new wave show with my good friend I've known for years as a childhood friend, Pat DiPuccio, who was one of the editors and founders of Flipside magazine, which was like the tome for new age and new wave punk. And Tony Fate's supposed to be on. There's so many bands he's been in, I can't remember off the top of my head. And then J.P. Duran's going to come by too, because he's another punk answer. That's not one of my expertises, but I think it'll be kind of cool to do a show like that.
Well, I think we need to dye your hair purple, though, for it.
Yeah, I'm thinking about, yeah, I think I'm going to spike it. No, I won't shave it. No. You can shave your hair. I'm going to, no. That's just not.
Well, then it's going purple then.
Anyway, that's what's up. So hopefully you guys can join us. It's going to be fun. It's a solid month for us here. And so I hope you guys can join us on that. It'll be a lot of fun. Okay, we're going to get to our guest, which I'm really looking forward to talk to. This album that he did, Tone Poems Live, is just amazing. And you're going to hear some interesting tone, and there's some interesting things behind the making of the album. They did some kind of unusual little things that we're going to talk about. Anyway, let's go to commercial. When we get back, we are going to talk to one of my favorite guitarists, Steve Hunter.
Hi, Kenny Burgle here from Sweetwater. We're super happy to support Jeff and Scott and the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Show on LA Talk Radio. Hey, we just kicked off today the amazing 24-day holiday giveaway at Sweetwater.com. Just go to Sweetwater.com to enter. No purchase necessary. Over $69,000 in prizes. One given away every day from today till Christmas Eve. This week, Jeff and Scott welcome heavy axe man Steve Hunter. He's rocked with pretty much all of the rock and roll world, from Mitch Ryder, Lou Reed, to Alice Cooper, just to name a few. Also, he recently did a DVD with our mutual friend, Tony Levin. Get it online, because it's awesome. And don't forget, when you're online, the Sweetwater amazing 24-day holiday giveaway at Sweetwater.com. Or call us at 800-222-4700 for more info. Thanks for listening. This is Kenny Burgle and Sweetwater saying, rock on with the flow.
Hey, this is Brent Mason with Jeff and Scott, Flow Guitar Enthusiasts, and enjoyed being on the show, and hopefully we'll get together again, and I'm going to go to bed. Let's wait. Thanks, guys.
We are back. It's Brent Mason. I still cracks me up when I hear that. I played that for a reason, because he's using a finger style that Steve uses throughout this album, and he changes from pick to finger style. We'll get into that in a minute. But I'm going to introduce, before I introduce Steve, I'm going to play a clip. And this is the opening title song called The Idler from the album, the new album. But it kind of gives you an idea where we're going with tonight's show. It's just a good groove, pretty solid, and you just listen to his tone, his sustain, just the character of his guitar. It's just amazing. So here we go. This is The Idler.
Thank you.
Steve Hunter, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing great, Jeff. How you doing?
Doing great. It's just it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. And the album last week and the DVD. It's Tone Poems Live is what it's called, and you can get the DVD. I recommend you get both because watching them play, you'll see what's going on and what he's doing there. And there's some great shots up close of Steve on his guitar, and it's amazing. I mean, this thing, what I was really impressed with throughout the whole DVD is how you switch from fingerstyle to pick real fast. It was really smooth, and you just it was like I couldn't. If I hadn't seen it, I wouldn't have known it.
But yeah, well, you know, it was something I learned a long time ago playing in bar bands back when right after I got out of the Army in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a local band in Decatur called the Light Brigade, and we did. Of course, in those days, you had to do like 5 sets. You know, you played from 8 until 2 in the morning. So we had to have a lot of songs. So we did some songs where there was some finger picking in the song somewhere. And I couldn't figure out how to do it. I didn't like trying to do it with a pick. I mean, I tried and it just felt sloppy. It didn't sound smooth or anything. Mm-hmm. And because I had taken lessons on lap steel, when I was a kid, I already had sort of the finger-thumb stuff down already. And it's funny how it sort of translates from lap steel up to regular guitar. It's really funny. It just, your hand just does it, only does it, instead of parallel to the ground, it does it vertically, and it works. Mm-hmm. But one night, I don't even know, I never thought of it. It's just, suddenly I found the pick between my first and second fingers, or around the second knuckle. And I could, when I put it there, I could still finger pick and not lose the pick. Mm-hmm. And I could pull it out really quickly if I needed to use it, if I wanted to go back to a pick. And it just became a habit.
Are you using a regular size pick, or are you using like a tinier, small pick?
Oh, it's a regular size pick. It's a medium, you know, regular size medium pick.
And you're using Rotosounds, right? That's what it says.
Yeah, you know, I know there are all these great, there are tons of great strings. There's Ernie Ball, there's Stay in Tune, there are D'Addario, there's a ton of them. But there's something kind of unique about the way Rotosounds sound. They're almost too bright when you first put them on, but you give them, you know, just a couple of hours or so, and they get this really nice, sweet tone that I like, with not too much high, but just about enough, you know, enough for me.
Yeah. Well, the album, yeah, you have a really mellow sound throughout the album, though you do kind of wail on a couple of things where you're getting some bite out of it. But did you use the Rotos before, like on Sweet Jane and stuff like that?
No. Back in those days, I don't even know if Rotos sounded right. It probably was. That was in the early 70s. What I tended to use mostly then was Ernie Ball, because I was trying to use the tiniest string possible.
Right.
And Ernie Ball was the only company that made 8s.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else was making 8s, or at least that I knew of. So yeah. I used 8s, Ernie Ball 8s, for many, many years. And then I finally graduated up to 9s. You know, just that 1/1000th of an inch, you wouldn't think it would make that much difference. But it's a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
And how it feels when you play and how it feels under your fingers and stuff. And then for a while, I went to 10s. I was playing 10s for quite a while. And then one particular time, I was going to change strings. I didn't have any more 10s. I just had a set of 9s. I put the 9s back on, and suddenly there was a tone in the 9s that I had been missing. The 10s brought out certain other things, but there was something in the 9s. There was a twanginess or something. I don't know what it was, but it responded differently to my fingers than 10. So I went back to 9s.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of the tonal difference.
Because you always had, when you played, especially with Alice Cooper and Lou Reed, you always had some amazing highs and harmonics in there. You always get that squeal I always liked where you'd
yeah, you know, I mean, I have to say probably there's a lot of it has to do with my fingers and just the way I learned how to play.
Yeah.
And the various things I was trying to learn how to do and try to go for and stuff like that. Because I'm convinced that 90% of your guitar tone is in your fingers. And the other 10% is really all the amp is supposed to do is amplify what's happening with your fingers. Mm-hmm. That's really all it should do.
Yeah.
And for many, many years, I practiced. When I practiced, I didn't go through an amp. I practice just acoustically.
Mm.
And then what happens is that it draws your attention to what's actually going on the guitar itself, without pedals, without amps, without anything. So you get actually can hear what your fingers are doing on the fretboard. Mm-hmm. And then you can fine-tune that. And if you can get it to sound pretty cool acoustically, then you know it's only going to sound better when it goes through an amp.
Right. Right. No, well, I'm going to play another clip, and then we'll talk a little more about the formation now. But this gives you an idea of what we're talking about. This is this song is called 222 West 23rd Street.
Right.
But listen to the tone of his guitar and listen to the sustain. How when he bends notes, he holds these notes, and it's just I want to know a little more about how you do that, because I don't think looking at your pedal board, I didn't see a compressor on there. So
there was a compressor on there.
There was.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll
tell you about it.
All right. Let's play the clip and we'll talk more about this.
Yeah.
Okay, we're back. Now, could you give us kind of the background how this album came to be before we get into the gear and stuff? How did you decide to do an album like this, which is like a in-studio live recording? Basically, you guys are playing live, mm-hmm. but in a studio situation, you know, more controlled environment.
Right. Well, the guy Bob. Just forgot his name.
Brian.
I'm getting old, man. I think Brian Brinkerhoff. He's a good friend, obviously not real good. I can't remember his name. But he called me. He had found me when we were doing the Kickstarter thing for Manhattan Blues Project. He had found me and got in contact with me about a year after Manhattan Blues came out, and asked me if I'd be interested in doing a DVD. And right after that, I said, no, not really. I wasn't really thrilled with the idea of doing a DVD. I don't know why. It just never appealed to me for some reason. I kept thinking, oh, great, we're going to go to some club and we're going to get on stage. It's going to be all uncontrolled. It's going to be really weird. But we talked. We talked back and forth. And he had ideas. I had ideas. So we decided finally that we both agreed that one of our favorite albums was Kind of Blue, the Miles Davis album.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that album was basically recorded live in the studio. As far as I know, there wasn't an overdub on that album. It was all recorded live. You don't need to do overdubs when you got Cannonball Adderley and John Coltrane and Bill Evans, people like that playing. You don't need overdubs. So, and I think they recorded that album in 2 days. So we thought, well, why don't we do that? Why don't we do a live album, but we'll do it in the studio and we'll video it. We'll videotape it.
Oh, okay.
So that's how the basic idea came down. And then the more we thought about it and kicked around the idea, the more we liked it. And then we had to start thinking about, well, who do we want to play on the album? And my first thought was Tony Levin, because he'd already played on a couple of tracks on Manhattan Blues Project. And then Phil Auberg came into the picture, because he and I and Tony all toured with Peter Gabriel on Peter's first solo tour. And then Alvino Bennett, the drummer, I had worked with in L.A. in several different bands, but mostly blues bands. Mm-hmm. I'd worked with him at B.J. Sharp. Down in Santa Monica, we used to play down at Harbell's all the time. And he's such an incredible drummer. I mean, like Phil Alberg said, Alvino Bennett can cut a groove through concrete, and that's really true. He is so good, his shuffles and everything. So that was the band, and that's how the album basically came about.
Yeah, no, he's solid. I mean, yeah. You can hear it in that opening clip that I played. It's just right in your face, which is great. No, I have to agree. That's just amazing. Yeah. You mentioned that you and Tony had worked on with Peter Gabriel. I'm going to play another clip from there real quick, because it's just a really cool finger-picking thing that you did. Obviously, there was an article that your wife Karen had posted up on your Facebook page about Gabriel saying that was like a critical part of the development of that song. And I agree. I think that what you did in the name of the tune is Salisbury Hill. But I think that what you did in there, it just defined the song. And it's kind of cool that even Gabriel was saying, like, yeah, that's true. That was part of the whole thing.
So that killed me when I saw that. It was really very cool him say that.
Right. So I'm going to play this clip, but listen to what he's doing. It's this again, what we were talking about earlier in the show. This is 100% taste. It's one of the best finger picking things I've ever heard in a long time. And take a listen. I think you'll agree. Definitely defines the song. Now, I want everybody to notice too, in playing that clip, how sparse things are. There's a lot of room in there, and when you see the video, when you look at the video, you can see there's something that just caught my eye. I'm like, wow. There's like just a snare and a kick drum, and then instead of a tom, he had a conga on the side, and basically he was using a stick at sometimes, not on this song, but on another one that had little tambourine things on it. But it was very, very sparse, but it sounds really, really full. You were telling me just a little bit before the show about you guys were discussing that. You and Brian were discussing that. Could you talk a little more about that?
Yeah. That was one of the things that Brian and I sometimes disagreed on how big the kit should be. And we had thought about just breaking it down to nothing but percussion. And then I kept thinking, well, no, you know, like some of these songs really have to have a backbeat. They got to have a groove, you know. The 222 is just based around a groove.
Mm-hmm.
And so is the Idler, for that matter. And there's a lot of them that need that bass drum, snare drum. So we compromised. And it was totally cool with Alvino. Of course, he was in on the conversation. He was cool with everything. We decided, okay, no toms, no big tom fills or any of that stuff. If the fills and everything should just come from Alvino's creative way of doing things. And like I mentioned earlier, he plays with Dave Mason a lot, and I think on most of it, he plays percussion. So he's already used to kind of playing really sparse. And so he was already adapted to it. And he was totally cool with it. And as it turned out, I think it was a great idea to just keep it really, really sparse. Because, listen, anytime you record any kind of record, one of the reasons why some of the earlier records in the 60s sounded so good, the two reasons. One is that 90% of them were recorded live, because back in the 60s, we really didn't know any other way of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is, they were the parts and everything were fairly sparse. And what happens is when they are sparse, then you can focus more on the wide sound of each instrument. In other words, there's more room for each instrument's sound to come through.
Right.
And that just makes everything sound better. As soon as you start layering stuff, something has to give. So you end up having to trim high EQ here and low EQ there and a compressor here and a compressor there. It all sounds good and everything, but it sounds different. There's something about recording live and really sparse that, first of all, it forces all the musicians to play together and listen very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
But also it gives all this room for you to hear each part and the tonality of each instrument. And that's why I liked it. It was a challenge, you know, because I have a studio at home. I love just layering all kinds of stuff. It's a lot of fun.
It was a big change from your Manhattan Blues project,
where
you were doubling and you were using a lot of different guitars. But the thing that amazes me is even with no toms, it sounds huge. Like when the drum and the bass, when Tony and Alvino come in on Salisbury Hill towards the end of the clip that I played, it's just full.
I mean, it's amazing.
It's a wall of sound there without a lot of guitars and a lot of drums, and it's full. And that's,
credit has to be given to Paul Landy. He's a great engineer.
Yes.
And he really knew how to get, and I think it was inspiring for him because he had so much room. So the bass drum could take up a lot of room and still leave tons of room for Tony because there's not going to be a whole bunch of other low stuff in there, you know, like toms and stuff, for instance. So Paul had a lot to do with the way it sounds. He really did.
Now, I noticed on the video, let's get into some of your gear. I noticed in the video you were using two main guitars, two custom-made Gretches that are your model. So
that's right.
And I was, the picture on your website shows the one with the, it's a seafoam green. It had, on the picture, it's two Filtertrons. But I saw on the video, it looked like you put a single coil in the bridge. Is that correct?
No, I put a single coil in the neck position.
The neck position.
Some type of Seymour Duncan in the bridge. I don't even remember what that neck pickup is, to be honest. But it's the one I was trying. What I wanted to do is I like a single coil in the neck position. It just sounds, it has a throatiness to it that Jimi Hendrix turned me on to that. I mean, when I heard him the first time do things like Little Wing and All Along the Watchtower and all this thing, he used the neck pickup a lot. And Red House is a great example. It sounds so beautiful. So I'm really hooked on the sound of a neck single coil.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked my guy at Gretsch if it'd be all right if we tricked up the pick guard and put a single coil up there, and it sounded great. I'm still experimenting with that position, so I'm probably going to try another pickup in there, but it'd be a single coil for sure.
And then I noticed you used the Kaler. The Kaler is an interesting, not too many people, I haven't seen too many in a long time around there. I always thought they were kind of smooth, but I know a lot of people didn't like them, but that's a nice, you got a nice, it's smooth. You get a nice vibrato out of that.
With the Kaler, you mean?
Yeah.
You know, I was one of the guys that when Kaler first came out, I loved that tailpiece far more than Floyd Rhodes.
Mm-hmm.
And not that I'm putting down Floyd Rose, but for what I like to do with a whammy bar, the Kaler was like, the best way to describe a Kaler to me, it's like it's a very high-tech, sophisticated Bigsby.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this amazing control over the amount of vibrato you can do with it and stuff like that. And that's why I always, and it's so smooth. It's so smooth that you can just barely touch it and get it to affect the mm-hmm. strings. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that. So yeah, I'm a Kaler guy.
Hey, Steve. Now,
he should give me one for free or something, huh?
Hey, Steve. I got a message from Lisa and JP, and they want to know about recording live. How critical is it for you to have the right room, right board, and right mic? How important is that to you? And how important is it to having the right engineer and producer?
Well, I think the most important thing is to have the right engineer and producer, because in this studio that we did this in, it wasn't like the perfect environment. But what we did was we sort of set it up as if it were a live gig. In other words, I had floor monitors, and Tony Levin had floor monitors, so we didn't have to use headphones. because we thought that would look kind of, Alvino had to, because he's the drummer and he's got it, and he was way off in the corner, so he had to have monitors would have bled into his kit. So Phil, Tony, and I all had floor monitors, so it was really like doing a live gig. But as far as the mics, you know, sometimes if you have a good engineer, you don't have to worry about the mics. Like, I've had things sound really good with ribbons on them and ribbon mics on them, and then I've had things sound just equally as good with a 57 on them. The engineer knows what he's doing. You know, he knows he's got his favorite mic, and he knows how to make it sound good. Just like, you know, a guitar player has his favorite amp and knows how to, you sort of leave that to the guys, you know. Now, when recording my own stuff, that's different. You know, like if I'm in my studio and I'm trying to get a sound, I may swap mics around. I may use a couple. You know, I experiment a lot more. But in a situation like this, I just wanted to concentrate on the performance. So we got a really good engineer, Paul Lanning, and Brian Brinkerhoff and I spent hours and hours on the phone deciding what we were going to do before we got there. So it was really wonderful, because all we had to do then was go in there and play.
Now, one other question I wanted to ask you is, and I don't know, maybe Jeff has got a clip for Riviera Paradise.
But, yes, I do.
That song is like one of Stevie Ray Vaughan's most beautiful tunes that he does. It's probably not like one of the most popular, but it is just gorgeous. Yeah. What inspired you to decide that you wanted to do your own cover on that?
Well, you know, it's funny because until we were going to leave for L.A., and I still was kind of looking for another tune. And I had picked one. I had picked, I think, a B.B. King song. I think we were thinking about The Thrill Is Gone and maybe a couple others. And I hadn't really picked one. And I was on Facebook, and somebody posted Riviera Paradise. I totally forgot about that song. And I listened to it again, and I was such a huge Stevie Ray fan when he came out. And he took blues and broke it right into the 80s. I thought that was so fabulous that he did that. You know, he was doing videos and he was breaking all the barrier. It was all the new kind of new agey, new wavy stuff and all that. And Duran Duran and all these people were doing all their sort of fashion rock, is what I used to call it. Yeah. Stevie Ray comes out with blues. Oh, my God, it was like a breath of fresh air to me. So, and he was an incredible player. I saw him a couple of times live. I saw him on that trip he did with Jeff Beck. And he just was the most amazing player. And I also heard him do that song live. And as soon as I heard it, I said, that's got to be on my album. I gotta learn it, and I got to pay homage to Stevie Ray, because he was my hero.
That's not an easy two to learn.
Yeah.
No, it's a little tough, yeah, but it was worth the effort.
All right, let me play the clip so everybody knows what you're talking about. This is Riviera Paradise.
Thank you.
a great, that's just great, tasty, very tasty.
So what effects did you use to accomplish that sound? Because that's pretty darn close to Stevie.
Well, I used the Seafoam Green Gretsch with the neck pickup, that single call neck pickup. Mm-hmm. And I, the compressor, by the way, that we had spoken about earlier that I was using was I think it's called a CS9 or something. It's a Boss compressor sustainer.
Oh, the CS3, yes.
The CS3, that's it. And I tell you, the main reason I used that pedal is because at the time, it was the only compressor pedal I had that had an attack knob. And what's cool about an attack knob is if you roll it back, so you slow down the attack, you let more transients go through before the sustain kicks in. So what that does is the picking and everything sounds a little more natural.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, when you speed up the attack, then you get this nice, like the country guys do use that a lot because it gives you a really nice smack, you know,
yeah.
Which is cool. I use that too. But on this kind of song, I really wanted the transients to come through more and the sustain come later. As far as anything else, that was the only pedal I used.
Oh, okay.
Really? So no tube scream or anything, huh?
Nope. That,
no,
it was. It was. We were going through two, 65 reissue twins. I had a stereo pedal board. So we're going through two of those. And I think that Paul added a little delay and a little reverb in the mix. But that's all I used for the tone, yeah.
Yeah, and that's a good example. We were just talking about the Kaler. He uses that effectively on that song.
I love that thing.
Yeah, they are very smooth.
They're really smooth, yeah.
Well, since we're talking gear here, let's get a little... I want to talk about there was another guitar you were using by the Seafoam Green. It was blue metallic.
Yeah, it's Lake Placid Blue.
Oh, it is Lake Placid Blue, okay.
Yeah. Is that the one with the girl on it?
Yeah.
That was nice.
And that what you have
not
on
just
because
the girl, but you know,
yeah. Got to keep your perspective when you're playing, you know.
Exactly.
Right. But you have a humbucker in the bridge, and then the neck, is that a P90 type pickup?
Yeah, that's exactly right. See, I'm a sucker for that single coil sound in the neck position.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't know what it is. Even back in the day when I had pickups. When I had guitars like SGs that had PAFs in the, you know, in the neck position and in the bridge position, the neck position PAF didn't sound quite as good to me. It was okay, but it was a little muddy.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got guitars that had P90s on them, I noticed in the neck position that it just sang. It had this vocal quality. And so I got hooked on it. I mean, I just loved that sort of single coil approach to the neck position. It just sounds like a voice.
Yeah.
Like it's woman tone, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely get that sound. Now, I looked at your website and tried to compare from the video the pedal board. So I saw a bunch of different things on there, and there's a couple of questions I have for you. I saw a couple of two or three Strymans. You had a Blue Sky, a Lex, and a Timeline.
Yeah.
But I saw something else I thought was interesting. You had two Pete Cornish pedals, an SS3 and a G2 TM. One was the SS3, I think, is an overdrive. The other one's distortion. Can you tell me about those?
Oh, those are lovely pedals. And this is a wonderful story. When I got the call to do that, we were going to do the Berlin show live with Lou Reed at St. Anne's Warehouse. When I flew out there, I didn't bring an amp. They said, no, bring an amp. We'll rent you something or we'll supply the amp. Don't worry about that. And I said, okay, cool. So I get out there and I wasn't quite getting the right sound, you know. It wasn't sounding good to me. So Luke says, here, why don't you try one of these pedals? Have you ever seen a Pete Cornish pedal? I said, no, I don't know anything. What's that? You know, it was kind of this ugly looking pedal. Looked like it was some guy made it in shop class, you know. And he said, well, try that. God, I plugged it in and the thing sounded amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, I said, Lou, this is amazing. Where'd you get this? And he told me the Pete Cornish story. And he said, well, do you like it? And I said, yeah, I love it. He said, well, it's yours. And he gave it to me. And I just, well, I almost had to change my drawers, really. I wasn't expecting that. So I gave him a big old kiss on the cheek and then I got hooked on Cornish pedal. So while we were doing the tour, we actually after we did the Berlin show in St. Anne's Warehouse, we did a tour of Europe and we played, where did we play? The Royal Albert Hall. And I invited Pete Cornish down and his wife to come see the show and asked him if he had another pedal he could bring me. And he said, sure. So he brought me down another pedal, very expensive pedals.
Yeah,
but I bought another one, and we plugged them in, and he stayed for the sound check, and they just sounded gorgeous. I've almost sold them a couple of times, and I just can't bring myself to sell them. I go, no, I can't do it. You know, they just sound so good. They're really amazing pedals.
Yeah, the picture on your website, the one that you have there, I think it was the one that Lou gave you, because it says Lou Reed on it.
It's Lou Reed on it, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think you could ever sell that. That's just too cool.
No, I can't.
Yeah.
And the other one, the S3, I think it was, the other one, it has a sample written on it, and that's the one that David Gilmour helped him tweak.
Ah.
And he was going to keep that to A-B it when he made other pedals. And he didn't have time to make another one, so he sold me that one. So I've got a Gilmour that Gilmour helped Cornish set up, and I got a Lou Reed Cornish. It's going to be hard to. I think I'm stuck with those pedals now. I can't sell them. You know.
No, well, they sound great. I mean, they
sound fabulous. Yeah.
And then you also have you have the Boss compression sustainer, the CS3. I saw a Chromatic TU2 Chromatic tuner from Boss, and a Boss line selector LS2. What's the line selector for? What do you to switch to?
I was gonna do some fancy smashy switching, but I never did it. I had it on the board just in case I wanted to switch some other things in and out. Like, in other words, it depended on how I had the Cornish pedals in the chain.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it bothers me a little to have it in front of things like delays and, of course you have to have, but sometimes it bothers me a little. So I thought maybe if I change my mind, I'll have this line selector, and I might put the S3 in when I kick that rather than kicking the pedal. If I kick the line, everything will stay in the same order, except suddenly the S3 will be in.
Right.
That's the thing about that line selector. You can do a variety of things with it. So I had it set, but I never used it. I mean, it was there, and I was, you know, I had it set up in case I wanted to, but the way the songs all kind of came about, I just didn't need it.
Yeah. Now I want to play a couple more clips, and the second clip I'll show more of that distortion, so you can get an idea what these pedals sound like. But I want to play this other one because I want to ask you a question about what Tony was doing on this. This clip is called Rubber Man, and it's interesting because when I first heard it, I thought, is he using a wah-wah? But it's actually Phil Auberg using doing like an electronic clav sound, which is really cool, but it does sound like a wah. And I have to admit, his keyboard playing, the way he complimented, he almost sounds like another guitar player a lot of times, which was really amazing. But anyway, this is Rubber Man, and we'll talk a little about this. I was watching the video on the DVD, and you know, if you listen to the bass, what Tony's doing, it's really, it pops at you. It sounds like he's almost thumbing it. But when I saw him on the clip, when you see him on the video, he has these two little sticks on his fingers, and he's tapping the bass. Now, can you tell me a little bit of – I mean, I was wondering – because I've heard that sound similar before when he's played with other people.
Yeah.
But I didn't know what it was. I just thought it's the way he was using his fingers. I'm like, this guy's got an interesting technique. But tell me a little more about that, because it's wild, and it's a great sound.
Well, I didn't say that much. I didn't ask him that much, actually, about how he came up with the idea, except I think it was something he was doing with Peter Gabriel.
Okay.
And they wanted something – he wanted something more percussive. And I think it kind of evolved from the drummer kind of playing the bass with his sticks, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, guys have done that before. But Tony thought about, well, maybe if I just put something on my fingers – and I think he also got the idea a bit from a koto player. A koto player has these big, long bamboo things on their fingers mm-hmm. when they play kotos. Anyway, I think it was a combination of all that. And he just experiment, you play around. And I think he's got these patented, or he's designed them or something. But he's really got them down, and he can do a lot of really interesting, cool stuff with them. And he's got it so that he's very fluid and smooth with them, which is really difficult to do with your two fingers.
Yeah, he's using a 5-string bass there, and that's not easy to isolate those. And he's just gently tapping, but he does like little, you know.
Was it a Stingray bass? Was that a Music Man?
Yeah, he uses a Music Man. Yeah. Is that does he sell those? Is that for sale? Those sticks or whatever? I don't even know what you call
them.
You know
what? I'm not sure. I never asked him. I just said, when I saw him get them out, I said, oh, great. I'm glad you're going to use those because I love those things. I saw him use them once, I think, on one of the Gabriel tours.
Oh, okay.
And I loved them. I thought they were awesome. So I was glad that he brought them and found a song to use them on.
It's a really cool sound, yeah.
Yeah, it is. Very cool.
And now, getting back to your guitar, which pedal were you using? I'm sure one of those, the Cornish pedal, is being used on that song.
Yes, but I can't remember which one. Because what I would do is I would kick one in and try some lines with that and see how that sounded. And then I would turn that one off and click the other one in. And I'd go back and forth, and then I'd forget which one I actually had on.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the S3, but I'm guessing.
Oh, okay.
It sounds a bit like that to me. I set them both a little differently. And actually, those two pedals, oddly enough, sound really good when they're both on at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It's really bizarre, but they sound great together. You know, they get a really long, big, sustained distortion sound. It's really amazing. My guess is it's the S3.
Hey, Steve, I have a question for you. Before you guys even recorded this, like, what goes into preparing for this kind of a recording? Did you guys rehearse for a week, a couple days? What did you guys do to get prepared for this?
Well, the first thing is I sent out the songs to everybody, and everybody was so professional. They learned or wrote little charts. Tony had little charts and stuff, and I think Alvino had his little scratches and stuff. So they were extremely well prepared when we got there. And when we got there, we didn't really have a lot of time to have a big, long rehearsal. In fact, we only had about a day and a half because the second day Alvino had a gig. So he had to, with Dave Mason, so he had to go do a sound check. So we only got like a half a day the next day. But the first day went really smoothly. I mean, we just zipped through everything. Those guys had done their homework so well. It was like, my God, this is going to be a breeze because they were so well prepared. We changed a couple things around. Some of the songs we shortened a little bit, like 222. We left a couple of things out and just let it kind of groove. And we changed a couple of things here and there. But basically, it was the way they were on the albums, pretty much, and when the way I sent them to them. And the guy, like I said, the guys just did their homework, you know. Phil called me a few times, and we talked over his part because he had the more complicated part, really, trying to come up with ways to cover a lot of territory. But we finally just said, Phil, just play what you want. You know, get the meat of what you're hearing and make it your own. And that's what he did, and that's what made it work so well, I think.
You know, kind of going with that, since you were learning Riviera Paradise so quickly, like, how did you learn it? Did you do it by ear, or did you find some sort of charts or tabs or something?
Well, no, I have to do it by ear because I can't see that well. So it limits my reading of charts. But no, I listened to it by – I just learned it by ear. Actually, I had worked it out when it first came out. I was so blown away by it. I wanted to know what he – how he did that. So I spent several days trying to figure out what the hell he was doing and finally figured it out. But that was many years ago. That was when it first came out. And I sort of remembered it, you know, remembered little bits and pieces. The intro is probably the hardest part. The rest of the song really just makes sense. It's, you know, it's a pretty standard progression. It just goes down in steps, you know. It's just beautifully written. I also did a version of his other instrumental song called Lenny on a compilation album many, many years ago. And so I kind of could figure out how he thought, you know, kind of could understand how he was approaching the parts as a guitar player. And I had heard that before he died, he was really leaning. He had heard Joe Pass or somebody like that and was really blown away by some of the beautiful chordal things those guys could do. I know what he means because I studied with Ted Green for a few years, and Ted used to just blow me away with some of the stuff he could do. So I think Stevie was trying to incorporate a little bit of that into his playing, and that's where Ruby Air Paradise came. But yeah, I just learned it by ear.
And real quick comment, I just got a thing. The Levin sticks are called Funk Fingers.
That's what they're called. Okay.
And they're $22 or $26, depending on what model you get. And they're apparently on a website called Expanding Hand Music, I think.
Great.
Maybe Expanding and Music. I don't know. Anyways, but yeah.
I want to get it.
Funk Fingers.
I like those.
Oh, I think they're awesome. Yeah, I do too.
It's now, a great name.
We're almost out of time. And what's next for you? Do you think you'll ever do this? Like this set of the Tone Poems live, you think you ever do it in front of an audience on stage?
Well, you know, we've been thinking about that. I'm having trouble with my eyes that limits some of my live playing a little bit. Now it's a little complicated to describe because I have glaucoma, so I have blind spots. Mm-hmm. It's not that I'm completely blind, but I have these blind spots, and unfortunately, they're right about in the area where my hand lays on the fretboard. So if I try to look at my hand on the fretboard, it disappears. So for an instant, it throws me off. Mm-hmm. I really noticed it the most in 2011 when I was out on the road with Alice. I really noticed that it was really bugging the crap out of me. And I mean, I thought about it, kicked around maybe doing a gig or two, because it's really hard to get Tony and Phil and Alvino all in the same room at the same time. Man, the clouds just parted for 3 days. And seriously, Tony left after all the taping and went back on the road. We were lucky to get him for 3 days, you know. So I don't know if we'd ever be able to use the same band.
Oh, okay.
You know, just because of schedule.
Well, any plans on another album? Are you going to come out with? I know you just finished this, but I'm like already ready for the next one.
I'm already working on the next one. I had some computer problems. My MacBook Pro died finally. The poor thing. It was 8 years old. You know, poor baby, and it died. So I had to get a new computer. Now everybody knows what that's like. You have to reinstall and reauthorize everything. Mm-hmm. And I had to bump up a couple of grades to Pro Tools 11. So I got to learn that. There's some new things in it, stuff like that. But I'm already thinking about new music.
Oh, that's great.
Now, I'm itching to go because it's been like 2 or 3 months of digging. I've had a lot of computer problems and display problems and authorization problems and everything. It's been going on for 3 months. So I'm just itching to get back to work. So, there'll be another album for sure.
Okay. Well, you must come back on and tell us and talk about the next album because I can't wait to hear it. Also, too, I want to really thank your wife, Karen Ann Hunter. She's a real sweetheart and really helped put this show together for us. And I just wanted to say thanks to her.
Oh, okay, so it's all her fault.
It's all her fault.
Thank you.
No problem. But listen, hang on until we want to talk with you after the show's done. We're at the end. I want to play one last clip, which is actually the last song on the CD, and it's called Of All the Times to Leave. And I think it just kind of defines defines the whole concept of the album. It's just pure tone, pure taste. It's just a great, great album.
And before you do, we want to thank Sweetwater for sponsoring the show. And then, because I probably totally boned the website, what is your String Change Buddy website?
stringchangebuddy.com.
Oh, okay.
Stringchangebuddy.com. So yeah. Or if you can't remember that, just go stevehunter.com. There's links there and stuff.
Yeah, and definitely go over to stevehunter.com. And he has photos. He has a photo gallery, and it shows a lot of this equipment that we were talking about. Go check it out. The guitars are beautiful. And we didn't even talk about his other guitars. He's got pictures of all these and these weird little amps that I've never seen before. That's a whole show in itself. But anyway, thank you so much. It's just always a pleasure to have you on the show. And I love the album, and I wish you much luck with it. The Steve Hunter Tone Poems Live is both on a DVD and CD, and I recommend you get both, because looking at him doing the stuff, it's really interesting. If you want to learn how to play like that, you see it, because the camera's right on his fingers. You can see what he's doing. And both of them are easily obtainable. You can get them on Amazon. I just looked them up, no problem. So definitely get the album, check it out, and we'll be listening and waiting for the next album from you. Yeah. And so I'm going to play this last clip, take it of all the times to leave. Thank you so much, and everybody, good night.